Thank you very much for the introduction. Really excited to chat with y'all tonight. This is a huge group. I wasn't quite expecting it, but that's really exciting. Looks like we have a really diverse background as well. So user research is a really, really broad topic, and people devote their entire careers to user research. So I'm going to try to put some rails around the scope of it a little bit and make a leap that you're all interested in product management. And so I'll try to talk about user research as it's been useful to me as a product manager in my career. And hopefully that'll be valuable and meet your expectations for tonight's talk. So just very briefly, a little bit about me, just to introduce. I'm a product manager. I've worked at companies of a bunch of different sizes. Most recently, I was VP of product at Scoot, which are the little red electric scooters all over town. I also worked at BigCommerce, where I led a much bigger product team. I had 7 or 8 product managers on my team, and it's an e-commerce platform that lets you build and manage an online store. So it was a really, really big product with a lot of different features and teams. And there was a lot of growth at that company, and that was really exciting. I was at Electronic Arts before that, where I worked on The Sims and SimCity and Need for Speed for a while. And then, as Laura said, I also was at MySpace back in the day. I was kind of there at like this time in MySpace's history. So we're the biggest site on the internet for a while, but also really interesting to see the other side of that when Facebook started kicking our ass. So anyway, I really love working with startups and fast-growing companies. It's really cool when you find companies that have found that product market fit and they know how to acquire users, and they're going from maybe like one engineering team to a huge company with a lot of different engineering pods, and now they've got a new design team and a bunch of product managers and all the challenges that come along with that. I'm really passionate about that type of environment. And then just personally, I'm a home brewer of beer. I have a smoker in the backyard. I do some barbecue, and one of my favorite places in the city is the disc golf course out at Golden Gate Park, so you can find me there sometimes as well. All right, enough about me. So tonight, I'm gonna, like I said, I'm gonna try to narrow down this really broad topic of user research and how to be relevant for product managers, both those who are already product managers and people who are aspiring to be product managers, because it's a really, really critical process and discipline for product managers to have. So I'll talk about what it is, some types of user research. I am gonna say that things like experiment design and some of that stuff is gonna be a little bit out of scope for tonight, because it is a really, really deep process, but I will certainly talk about different methods that you can use for user research and when they might be most relevant. So we'll touch on that. But also things like the analysis of the data that you get and things like that. I'm happy to speak to that in the Q&A session toward the end, but I'll move through that a little bit quickly during the bulk of the presentation. We'll go through all the steps of the process, and then I'm going to finish it with a framework that I've used at previous companies that I think has been really useful as a product manager to do something with the data that you get out of a user research project. It's great that you go through this process and you might have a perfectly designed experiment and get these wonderful insights, but now what do you as a product manager do with that, and how does that influence your road mapping and prioritization process? And so I'll give you a framework, like I said, that I think can help you in that regard. So the guiding question, though, tonight is how do product managers gather user insights and then use them to build successful products? So what is user research? It really is about building a deeper understanding of your user, their needs, their motivations, how they want to use your product, how they are using your product. And the goal is to really get actionable data, or at very least, testable data that you can use in the future for another iteration through a user research process. It's really important that you get data that you can then, take a next step with, and that they're not just insights that you wind up leaving behind as you move forward, because otherwise user research can be a really expensive and wasteful process if you're not structuring your experiments correctly. But as product managers, what I think user research is most valuable for is understanding who that product is for and why it's valuable to them and how they want to use your product. And those insights, I think, are what, as a product manager in that discipline, user research is going to be most valuable for. It also improves your chances of success when you're building products and mitigates some of the risk of making bad assumptions about how your users want to use a product or what their needs are. And it helps you build products that really meet their needs and that are successful through the eyes of the user, which is really what product management is all about. This slide, I'll break this down a little bit, and I'll share this deck with you as well, because there are some other slides in here that are pretty dense, like this one. But there are a couple key methods or types of user research. There's quantitative research and qualitative research. Quantitative research is usually dealing with large aggregated data sets. You'll get these from, you know, surveys or from analytics from your product. So if you've got Google Analytics or things like that, or Mixpanel, whatever installed in your product, they're good for telling you how people are using your product or how they want to use your product, but usually with larger data sets. They're good for validating or invalidating hypotheses as well. On the flip side, you've got qualitative feedback, which is a bit more individualized in a lot of cases. It's mostly, and with all caveats, it's a little less structured than quantitative feedback in a lot of cases. And it really helps you get individual one-on-one insights from your customers. It's extremely valuable to have a conversation with your user and to hear their feedback about your product in their own words. A lot of times they will use language that you don't use inside the building. And those small differences, even just the things that they call certain features compared to what you might call them internally, those insights can be really, really valuable when you're developing your products. So that's qualitative research. Let me take a quick look at my notes here. And those are usually, the qualitative research is usually gathered through things like interviews. They can be more open-ended surveys. So instead of like, you know, multiple choice, like rate this 1 through 5, it's more like give me a short answer or response, things like that. And then also traditional focus groups like research panels and things like that is where you'll typically get qualitative research. So those are the key categories there. I do have another version of this a little bit later on where we'll talk about different types of research and which ones fit in different categories and the methods that you can use to get those different categories and when they're relevant or not. So great, those are the different types of research, but where do you start? So this is kind of an accepted process that's becoming more and more standard in the industry. It's this, you know, user research spiral. It looks to me a lot like the lean startup build, measure, learn loop, which I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with. And it is very much about testing hypotheses as quickly as possible and trying to iterate through this loop as quickly as you can. So similarities there with that lean startup loop. So let's start at the beginning, defining your objectives. Research really needs a goal. It's important that you know why you're embarking on a research project and what you are trying to learn from that project. Why are you doing that research? Do you need a lot of data or just a few key insights, right? So when you're trying to do an A-B test, for example, a lot of times you're going to need pretty big sets of data in order to validate or invalidate some hypothesis and hit statistical significance with that. And so there are types of research that make a lot of sense for that type of goal or hypothesis. On the other hand, you might have projects where you just need a few key insights. So if you're trying to, you know why people are using your product once and never coming back, sometimes you have 2 or 3 conversations with people and they all kind of say the same thing to you, and all of a sudden you've hit on some signal that can be really, really valuable, right? So the type of question that you're answering will dictate the method of user research that you do, and we'll talk about that as well. To that point, you know, do you have a hypothesis? You know, do people like red buttons over green buttons, or are you just trying to understand some unexplained phenomenon, like why people are churning from your product? I also think it's important to ask yourself what data you have already. In a lot of cases, you can answer the question that you have with data that already exists. And this is why it's really critical to define that goal up front. You know, in some cases, if you're trying to know like what your most popular content is on your site, sometimes you can look at the data, you know, your Google Analytics or whatever it is, and answer those questions very quickly. And so again, it kind of harkens back to the Eric Ries lean startup thing, which is how do you answer some of these questions as quickly and as cheaply as possible, right? So key takeaway here is define your research objectives up front, set those goals, and then that can influence the rest of the process here. It's really important to get it right up front. So the hypothesis is the next step. So when you talk about what you're trying to learn, it's important to outline some of the assumptions that you might have about your product. I think that developing and testing hypotheses or validating and invalidating hypotheses is a key skill for product managers. If you take a very hypothesis-driven approach to product management and you define the assumptions or the things that kind of have to be true in order for your product to be successful, it can really reduce the risk of you building unnecessary features and spinning your wheels a lot. So learn that skill, learn what it means to define good hypotheses, and then find ways to quickly validate or invalidate them. So in this step, again, think about those assumptions, what needs to be true in order for your product to be successful, and that can then form a series of hypotheses that will influence your research. So these two steps, arguably everything cascades from this, right? From thinking about your goal, defining the hypothesis, and then the methods all kind of flow from there. So there are a lot of different types of research methods. Again, people devote their entire careers to optimizing some of these processes and finding good objective ways to create tests that produce reliable data. Again, I know this is a bit of an eye chart, so we'll certainly share the presentation with you afterwards so you can peruse this. But you'll see that there are some types of studies that are appropriate depending on the type of research that you're doing. And I'm happy to answer specific questions about some of those. If you want to pose some like hypothetical scenarios in the Q&A, we can talk about what might be a good approach for working through those research projects. But I'm going to move through rather than try to go through every single one of these bullets and in detail on their pros and cons and things like that. I will say, though, that usability.gov is a great site. They've got some really good, clear material about some of these different types of research methods. And so I would encourage you to go check some of those out if you're looking for just like a quick, you know, flashcard type breakdown of pros and cons for different types of usability studies. But again, happy to go into depth in any ones that are interesting to you tonight. I will give you one little kind of rule of thumb here when it comes to methods, and you know, take this with all of the necessary caveats and treat it more as a guideline rather than a law of physics. If you're trying to validate some very structured hypothesis, like we think people like red buttons more than green buttons, usually quantitative research is the way to go for that kind of thing. If you have something a bit more open-ended, or you need to explore or understand some unexplained user behavior, like why are people using my product and not coming back, a lot of times qualitative research is going to be the preferred approach for that. Conducting the test, very dependent obviously on the method that you're using. So I'll just talk a little bit about some areas or some ways that you might recruit some users or give you some categories here just to kind of get the juices flowing. But again, all very dependent on the type of research that you're doing. Your test subjects can take a lot of different forms. They can be your existing users if you already have them, in which case I strongly encourage you to talk to them directly, pick up the phone. It's amazing to me how many people who work in product and design and engineering don't talk to customers very regularly. I think it's incredibly valuable, and so I would encourage you to do that. Your colleagues can be a good source, especially when you're trying to get quick qualitative feedback. You know, the hallway test with wireframes and things like that can be super, super valuable. Your target customers, so if you're a startup and you are trying to determine or find the feature set that you need to kind of find that product market fit, obviously you don't have a lot of existing data, and so talking to target customers would be very valuable there, and we can go into some details for how you can recruit some of those folks. The other one that kind of gets overlooked a lot but I think can be really, really valuable are your competitors. especially if you're working in an industry where you have some established competitors that are bigger than you and have more resources and have built more or less successful products. A lot of times you can stand on the shoulders of giants a little bit and look at your competitors and how they've arranged things, like, you know, what features go in my free plan versus my pro plan, that kind of stuff. They, in a lot of cases, have asked those same questions and maybe have done the user research for you. And, you know, obviously you want to have your own kind of unique position with your product, but some of these questions can be answered pretty quickly just by taking a look at what other people are doing. So that's conduct. Again, very, very dependent on the type of research that you're doing. So again, let's dig into these in more detail if there are methods that are interesting to you, and I'm happy to chat through some of those. So synthesis, this is the last step in this research spiral here. It's about taking the data that you have, that you've collected from your research process, and turning it into something that's actionable. And I'm going to talk about this with the framework that I mentioned before, get into, you know, a way that you might take some of this feedback and put it into something a bit more structured, so that you as a product manager can take a next step with it. But the idea here is, you know, to ask yourself, was our research project successful? Did we validate or invalidate our hypotheses? Did we learn what we were trying to learn to accomplish our research goal? Which is usually to answer some guiding question that you have. So that's kind of step one. I also think it's really valuable to look for unexpected results in your research. Sometimes the nature of the test that you've run or the way that you've structured some research can result in some unexpected feedback. Again, you know, the language that people use to describe your product can sometimes be very different than how you talk about it inside the building. And there can be some really great insights there. So it's good to reflect on other things that you've learned that are outside of some of this very structured, hypothesis-driven testing. And then ultimately, again, it's about collecting that actionable data, or at least data that you can use for a future test, for another iteration through this loop. It's okay if you go through a research process and you don't necessarily have an immediate next step and everyone is just full steam ahead. It's okay if the research results in new hypotheses that are worth running through another research test. And the process can be very similar, or it might take a completely different form depending on the results you get there. But the goal being that you have some data that defines what that next step is, be it going into product planning, building new features, or taking another pass through this research cycle. Okay. So now what? We've done our research. We have some data. We think it's good. I feel that product managers are constantly responding to two key questions, right? What do we build and in what order, right? That's kind of the core of a product manager's job in a lot of ways. And that is, as many of you know, much easier said than done. And user research can play a really valuable role in that. But I think it's important to have some kind of framework that lets you take that user research and turn it into product features, and then to help you prioritize the work that you do next. Sometimes in user research, you can find a lot of different gaps, a lot of different needs that are going unfulfilled with your product. But deciding which ones you fill first can be very daunting. So I think we can use this user research, the results and the data that we get, to develop, and I use this term very loosely, personas, and to then help you define what they need and which things they value most. And that can then influence your road mapping and your prioritization process. So let's dig into this a little bit. There's this kind of product market strategy framework or product persona framework that helps you understand these needs. Step one is identify your target user, right? Who are you building this for? This could be, you know, aspiring product managers, it's soccer moms, real estate agents, engineers who are building Alexa apps, whatever, right? But who is that target user? And let's be really clear about what that segment is. You've got that target user. Now define the features that are considered differentiators. And what I mean by that are the things that make someone choose your product over a competitor, right? And this, in a lot of cases, needs to come out of your research, right? But what are those things that are just the killer features that people talk about when they say, this is why I use your product, right? They need to knock it out of the park. They need to exceed expectations. And so one way that you might define that is that they're, when people are, if you're doing an NPS survey on it, they're the things that people are saying, these are nines and tens, they're promoters. Are you guys familiar with NPS, Net Promoter Score? Some nods. Okay, so Net Promoter Score, it's that, the question that you probably see a lot. How likely are you to recommend this product to a friend, and you score it 1 through 10? You're considered a promoter if you score 9 and 10. You're neutral if you score a 7 or an 8, and you're a detractor if you score anything below a 7. And then you get on this like 100 to a negative 100 scale, and it shows you, you know, how satisfied people are, and it can be a good proxy for growth or for churn, especially in SaaS companies. So that's what I mean by NPS here. So these differentiating features, and you probably have, you know, 3, 5 of them max, something like that, or at least categories of features. They've got to knock it out of the park. So define what those differentiators are. What are the things in your research that people say, this is why I use your product, or this is why I would use your product if it had this feature. This would make me pick yours versus a competitor. Okay, you got differentiators. Now define table stakes or core features. These are the things that just have to be there, right? Your product's not viable without it. It's like a login screen or, you know, whatever. It's a play button controls if you've got like a podcast app, right? Those kind of things. Define those core features. You don't get a whole lot of credit for them being there, like play controls on a podcast app, but you're definitely going to get dinged if they're not there, right? Or if they're subpar. Okay, so this is where that kind of NPS 7 or 8, you need them to, you know, you want people to be like, yeah, that's good enough, right? And if it's falling below that, then you've got a gap that needs to be filled. And the same thing with the differentiators in the kind of 9 and 10 category, right? So differentiators and table stakes, and lay these out and then put them on a matrix. And so I'll show you the matrix in one more slide. So you've got these laid out on the matrix, which I'll show you in just a second. And you can then use the results of your research to identify some gaps or like feature gaps, things that you just don't have. Like, hey, I've got this podcast app and people would really use it if they had like a 2x button so that they could listen to podcasts really, really fast, right? And that would be a reason that they would use my app versus someone else's app. And I don't have it, so I need to build that feature, right? So identify those feature gaps or quality deficiencies. Like my login page is a nightmare and the fields are really small and it doesn't really work on mobile and all that kind of stuff. And people complain about it every time they have to come into my product, right? So find those quality deficiencies as well and ask yourself, are those features there and are they good enough? And then also do this exercise as best you can for your competitors, right? And so there's a bit of an art to this. You have to kind of make some informed estimates with that. But are your differentiators really better than your competitors' differentiators? Or do they see them that way? And are your core features really different than, or as, you know, as good as they need to be? You know, we did this at BigCommerce, and, you know, this would be things like adding a product, right? Everyone needs to be able to add a product to your online store. You know, is that feature there? Is it good enough, right? There are other things like maybe your storefront, your theme, where that can be a real differentiator for your product. And if you've got the best themes, then people will pick your platform versus another, right? So identify those feature gaps. And then the last step is prioritize or use this as an input into your prioritization process. And I feel that it's maximum impact is what you want to be going for when you're doing that prioritization. And so how do you get there? Well, typically that's that you're identifying the features that are really dragging down your overall product user satisfaction. And the things that typically drag them down are the products or the features that represent the bulk of a user's interaction with your product. So my podcast app example, people are pretty much always on that play screen. So if I've got some subpar, like it's really a pain, and I've got like kind of 3s and 4s on my NPS responses there, that might be something that I'd want to focus on first, because that's where people spend 80% of their time in my product. Whereas my login screen, even though I know it's terrible, they do it once, and then every time they open the app, they never see it again. And so it represents such a small percentage of the amount of time that they're using my product. And so you can then go for that maximum impact and raise the overall user satisfaction if you're prioritizing the work that you do in that way. Okay, so let's take a look at an example here. I mean, this got real blurry on this. So let's say that my target user is aspiring product managers, and I'm building a class or a series of classes that you can take to learn how to be a product manager. And so I've defined some differentiators. Well, if I'm an aspiring product manager, then what's most important to me probably is getting a job as a product manager. So that's a true differentiator. If you can help me get a job and guarantee that I'm going to do that, then that's why I would pick this school versus a different school. And so there might be some sub features in here as well, like, oh, they've got this cool certification that I can put on my LinkedIn profile, and they've got great resume reviews and mock interviews and things like that. And that all goes in that category. I want them to have the best instructors. So people who have been PMs and they've done it at really cool companies, and they give good presentations. And if one school has them and another doesn't, then that might be a reason I would pick that. And then, an alumni network is another one here, right? And so you can see these kind of differentiating features. These are the reasons that I would pick one product versus another product, right? And then the table stakes. Well, most people who are doing this kind of program, they already have full-time jobs, and so I need to have flexible schedules, and I need to have a pretty cool facility that's got like a good location, and it's got really fast Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff. And if I don't have that, or if my Wi-Fi is really slow, then I'm probably going to get dinged, right? And then, of course, the course materials. I want to be able to access them online, that kind of thing, right? So I've organized all my features into these different categories here. And then using some user research that I've done, and in some cases, it's really hard to get feature-level NPS scores, so use some informed estimates here if you have to, but better if you can use your real user research. And put some scores against these, right? So, everyone who goes through my program gets a job, so I'm doing a really great job there, and they're giving me nines. I've got the best instructors, so I'm getting really good scores there. And, of course, my alumni network, because everyone who goes through this class just winds up rising to the top of every company that they join. I've got a great score there. And then here, down in my table stakes, cool, I've got mostly sevens and eights in there. But maybe I've got a couple, hey, I just started recording video, and so I don't have a whole archive of them, and so maybe I'm a little short there, and then that's also kind of hindering my remote access because not all the content is available. And so, cool, I've found a couple areas where I might want to focus my product efforts and my prioritization, my roadmap, okay? So hopefully that you find this framework useful, and again, I'll share it so you can have it. Let's recap, and then we can get into kind of more open Q&A session. User research is about reducing risk and improving your chances of success for building great products, right? They help you avoid making bad assumptions about how your users want to use your product. And then ultimately, if you're using some kind of framework like this, then maybe you're finding ways to exceed their expectations as well. The type of research that you do needs to be a function of your goals and the questions that you're trying to answer. So there is no silver bullet for this is how you do user research, right? There are a lot of different ways you can do it. There are new methods that are emerging all the time. I spoke with a woman recently who does market research, and she will go in and infiltrate market research panels and participate in the panel. And then try to strike up conversations between questions and stuff, because she gets a much more natural, response and feedback than the structured questions that you get with the two-way mirror, right? So there are all sorts of new methods that are popping up. But the one that you choose needs to be a function of what you're trying to learn, right? Good research. If you're successful, you're going to have actionable data to work with. It's going to let you take some next step. And in some cases, that next step is going to be just a testable hypothesis that will let you go through another iteration of that research process. And then lastly, understanding the features that your customers value most as a result of that research is critical to the road mapping and prioritization process. And there are ways that you can understand which features are most valuable and how to prioritize them so that you can make maximum impact as quickly as possible. So that's all I've got for the presentation today, and I'm happy to open it up for questions.
User research, when you're doing more open-ended user research, particularly maybe in like a B2C context, what have you found are really effective ways for of reaching out to customers and like actually talk? Are you calling them on the phone and like how often are you doing that?
Okay, so I'm going to repeat the question for the folks. So you're asking about when you're conducting research, especially open-ended research, what are good methods for reaching out to the users and getting in contact with
Hitting
them?
them, are you not?
Yeah, and so are you mostly talking about people who are your existing users
Yeah.
or I think it's actually really easy. I think people make it more complicated than it needs to be. Pick up the phone and call them. Honestly, it can be that easy, especially as a product manager. You'd be amazed how willing people are to talk to someone who builds a product that they use, right? Especially if you're talking about real open-ended feedback where you just want to get kind of qualitative answers and hear things in their own words, pick up the phone and reach out to people. In some cases, that might be viable, in some cases not. I had the luxury at Scoot of being able to like go walk to one of the locations where you could park a scooter and talk to people about it, right? So
That's great.
you can just walk straight there and interact with people. And so depending on the type of product that you're doing, you might be able to do something like that. At the very least, I think you can reach out through emails or in-product messaging or notifications on a website, something like that. And hopefully you can get away with getting feedback from people without incentivizing them to do so. There are all sorts of pitfalls that come with incentivizing people to respond to your survey. You're going to get some, self-selection, and it might not be a good representative sample. And so you have to treat that research appropriately. But the first thing that I would do if I had the ability to do it, like if I had access to people's phone numbers and things like that, and it was the type of service where I could do that, would be to call my users, at least for qualitative research.
Do you have any examples in practice where you use any type of data analysis and you came up with I guess quantitative answers that were not easily apparent to, I guess, the rest of the leadership team?
Yeah, there's a fun one. Years ago when I was at MySpace, we were trying to understand why some people would stick around and why other people would not, right? They'd create, oh, I'm sorry, and the question just for everyone is examples of user research, especially quantitative, where you've gotten good insights that weren't otherwise apparent. So anyway, we were trying to understand why some people would sign up and just really go to town on the site and why other people would sign up and just never come back. And we did some pretty serious quantitative analysis there, and we had huge amounts of data back then. It was, the biggest site on the internet for a while. There were like 75 million users, and so we were collecting a lot of data. And one of the things we found is that if you had eight friends, you would usually come back, because if you had eight friends, then you'd start to get more, posts and comments, and there were photos that were shared and things like that. And so you had a good experience on MySpace, and that's why you had a top eight. The group of friends you had to add on your profile, right? Facebook found something really similar, and I think there's been articles and stuff written about. For them, it was 25 friends. When they hit 25, they, you had enough content in your news feed to make it worth coming back to like scroll through it. And so, both of us were building things to get you to that friend milestone faster. Things like people you may know, or address book importers, where you take like old school email address books and import them into the site. Or, with Facebook, it was pick which school you went to, and then they'd show you a bunch of people who went to the same school, right? So, I mean, that was one example that was interesting.
What was the process of like determining that it was eight friends, and how did you guys figure out
Well,
the process?
you can look at a lot of different dimensions, right? Like, I mean, you're with that, you're basically talking about regression analysis, where you're trying to, you know, see the effect on one single variable, right? And so we would look at a lot of different variables. Say, all right, let's take this bulk of users that we think are good, successful users, and these ones that are churning out, and let's run those kind of analyses against a bunch of different variables. So was it the number of photos that you uploaded? Was it the number of times you logged in your first 7 days? Was it friends? You know, what was it that you, you know, made a status update, right? So we would look at a lot of those different variables and try to, you know, run, basically create these curves where you'd say, all right, you know, this person added one friend, what's their retention rate? This person added two friends, what's their retention rate? And we'd go through it and try to find big jumps or big drop-offs where we would see some kind of threshold where it's like, ah, it works. Let me get this side of the room. I'll come back to you. Hey.
So my idea is a marketplace, so I have to connect to parties.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you have a specific advice for that? Because I would have to do the research with both parties. That's the first question.
Okay.
And the second one, when your customer is like a company, not a person, who do you interview inside the company?
Okay, good question. So the first part of that question was, if you're building a marketplace, what, you know, that has buyers and sellers and you're facilitating that transaction, how do you do research in that regard? And then the second part of the question was, you know, if your users are companies, so if you're like a B2B company, who do you talk to in that company? So the first part, about the marketplaces, I actually think you've got to be clear about what the goal is, right? Like it's a little too broad in that, and maybe we can chat about how we can narrow that down a little bit, but what is it that you're trying to learn there, right? And you've got to be more specific about, like, you know, what is it that my sellers need in order to want to come and post their products or services on this marketplace, that kind of thing, or how do the products and services need to be presented so that the buyers, you know, will actually buy those things. Airbnb, there was a story, you know, where they, you know, were hosting these apartments and things like that, and they weren't getting a whole lot of traction. And so they went and talked to their users, to the hosts specifically, and they tried to talk to them about their experience and how they were doing and how many listings or how many bookings they were getting and things like that. And after they chatted with a handful of these users, they realized that one of the things they were really struggling with was like the quality of the photos in their listings. They were like, you know, people didn't know how to take pictures of their apartments and stuff like that. And so that then led them to go and like send some professional photographers, which I think were just the founders. But they went with like a fancy camera and took these beautiful photos, and all of a sudden overnight they started seeing this huge lift in engagement. So anyway, I think you've got to be specific about what it is you're trying to get at with the research with that one. With the second part though, about B2B companies, when you've got like, when your customer is a company that has a lot of different people in it, I would say two key guidelines to figure out who to talk to. One are the users of your product within that company. So who's actually at the control panel driving the product? And the other is the buyers, right? And they're not always the same person. In fact, a lot of times they're not, right? Especially if you're building like marketing technology, you'll have like, you know, a CMO or someone like that, or a VP of marketing that writes the checks. But then there's some junior marketing person who's actually getting in there and using the product and setting things up. And so you want to think about both of those categories, because they're both important, right? One person's going to decide, yeah, I'm going to pull the trigger and buy this thing. The other person is going to say, yeah, hey, head of marketing, this thing is so valuable, and look at all the insights I'm getting, and it makes my life so much easier. And so you want them to have a good experience, too. All right, go ahead. So the question is, all these other topics are fine and good if you have an existing product with a lot of users and data and things like that. But if you are just getting started and you have a product that doesn't have that yet, where do you start? You're at the stage where you're creating a bunch of, you have a bunch of assumptions or hypotheses, right? In fact, much like the lean startup stuff, which I've referenced a lot tonight, everything that you're doing is an assumption until you get it in the hands of your users, right? And so, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just the stage that you're at. And so you've got to continue to make some of those assumptions and then think about how you can decide, how you can figure out whether or not they're true. And so in terms of users or people you might want to do user research with, you've got to at least have a hypothesis about who your target user should be. Who are you solving this problem for, right? And if you don't have that, then, you know, you got to find it immediately, right? Because you need to know who has this problem. And if no one has it, then find another problem to work on, right? But if you know that people have this problem, then you've got some assumptions about who they are. And then it's a matter of kind of thinking a little bit about who they are and getting in their shoes a little bit. Like, what does a day in the life of that user look like? And this, that process, defining that day in the life, that can be valuable for companies of any stage, right? Yeah, right? What do they do when they wake up? Where are they living? Which bus lines do they ride? You know, what are they looking at on their phone when they're commuting or they're on a lunch break, whatever, that kind of stuff, right? Think about that day in the life, and there'll be all sorts of opportunities where you can try to get in front of people. In some cases, you're going to, you know, maybe you create like Facebook ads and say, you know, hey, we're solving this problem that we know you have. Come learn about it and tell us what you want, right? And you can link to some survey that you've created. It could be that you actually go get in front of them. Like if you know that they all like go to the gym, right? Then you can go show up at a gym and ask them those questions, right? So you got to start with that assumption and then just try to validate, right? You had one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting question. So the question is, if you're doing a B2B product and you've got these companies and you find people to talk to about it, how do you talk to them without like getting them too excited and getting their hopes up and then letting them down if you don't build that product or if it manifests in a different way? I don't know how scared of that problem I would be. Right? It's I don't want to be dismissive of it because it could be a very real thing, and I don't have all the context. But if you talk to your users about some feature and they get really excited about it, that's a good signal, right? Like that's a good situation because you've got a very strong signal from someone. And a lot of times when you're doing research, especially things like A/B testing, which I know is a really, really common way to do user research because it's really easy to implement and execute, especially with tools like Optimizely nowadays. A lot of times, especially with A/B testing, you're going to get no noise, like really quiet kind of signals and lots of inconclusive tests. So if you're getting people really excited about things and you're getting like a real signal, that's a good thing. So I think I would be happy if I had that sort of thing. Now, you need to manage their expectations, obviously, and that's a completely different process for, you know, being honest with them about when a feature like that might exist, if it ever will. But that, I think, setting expectations is more of the thing I would worry more about rather than, oh man, I mentioned this feature and they got really excited about it. Maybe that was a bad thing, because I think that's actually a really good scenario.
So you have a lot of assumptions, and then you're kind of the first product manager in that company. So how would you kind of like go and do user research in that setup where you know like you don't. where you can go and prioritize it and bring some, you know, data to the table.
Got it. Okay, so the question's about a company that I'm assuming is kind of pre-launch, let's say, or very early, pre-product market fit maybe, and there's this big wish list of features. How do you kind of validate some of that with user research? I would go back to the hypothesis driven, or like the assumption driven product development process. So start by put the wish list of features aside, right? Because you don't know what features you need yet, right? You might know what features you think you need, but if it's a list of features right now, set that aside for a minute. Create a list of assumptions that have to be true in order for your product to be successful, right? So, you know, if what is it like, what's a cool product? Like ClassPass, right? The gym thing where you can get like a subscription and go take classes to a bunch of different gyms and stuff like that. There were a bunch of assumptions about user behavior that had to be true in order for that product to be successful, right? That people wanted to take a bunch of different types of classes and that people wanted to go to a bunch of different gyms around the city in order to do that. And that people would pay for some additional subscription on top of their gym membership in order to accomplish that, right? And there's a huge list of these things that kind of have to be true for the product as you see it today to be successful and find that product market fit. Frame the problems that way. And then find the biggest ones or the ones that are most important, right? Like, wow, if this assumption that people want to take a bunch of different types of classes isn't true, we're dead in the water, right? So put that at the top of the list and then think about ways that you would prove that assumption true or not, right? And the methods for your research are going to flow out of what the nature of that assumption is. But I would start with that rather than saying, like, here are the list of features that we want to build. Let's, you know, figure out which ones are right or how we should build each of them. Start with the assumptions first. Cool. Yeah?
Are there any good ways of determining the reliability of your user research data? For example,
yeah.
You know, you're going to the consumer space. Consumers love the initial concept, but you want to know if they're actually going to be willing to put money into it. They might say they're super excited, but then
got it. Okay, so the question is, how do you determine the reliability of your user research and kind of specifically, like, if people get excited about a feature or they say they do in user research, how do you know they're actually going to be willing to pay for it? That's a good question. That's a tough one. I mean, I would ask them, first of all, right? Like, cool, I'm glad you're so excited about this. How much would you be willing to pay for it? Right, and get them to say, because in some cases they're going to flat out say zero, right? Like, sounds neat, I might use it, but if it's not free, you know, no thanks. Like a shopping list, like a grocery list app. It's like, if you're building a grocery list app, I probably need it to be free, or I'm not going to use it, right? Because I have so many alternatives out there. And it's a weird concept for me. You need to pay for like a list or, you know, that kind of thing, right? So there's too much, too big of a leap there. So ask them. That would be the first thing. Beyond that, validating how user research is valid or not. There are a lot of layers to that onion, right? We got to be careful with that one because the validity of your testing, like, there are a lot of different places in the process where it can sort of break down, right? The way that you frame your question or your goal up front, the way that you conduct the test, the way that you gather the data, the way that you analyze that data, all that kind of stuff, right? There are a lot of different ways that you can kind of break that down. I think it's, if you're really asking, though, about, like, whether or not they're willing to pay for something, I think, one, ask them if you can. Two, if you're at a point where you've got a product or something like that, then you might be able to experiment with pricing. And this might be a good A/B test, right? Where some people who land on your site, you show them like free, some people you show them $10, some people you show them $20, whatever, and you can try to find where those price sensitivities are.
Survey that you're doing, immediately people get very,
very conscious about what they're saying.
Yep.
So they might not give you very true answers. But if you're doing something like the woman did, like the example where she infiltrated some of the people from her research group. So that's a very natural conversation. So that way you might get like very honest and reliable answers.
Yeah, that's a good point. There are all sorts of biases that are going to find their way into your research. And yeah, as soon as you say it's a survey, you've already framed it in some way, and you need to acknowledge the kind of context or bias that you've introduced in that way. And yeah, there are ways that you can kind of get around that a little bit. A lot of times, you know, quantitative research where you're kind of looking at data that people don't know you're collecting, or they maybe they know, but they just don't think about it. But it's like how you're using my product on a daily basis, that can in some ways kind of strip out the bias. Yeah, I thought the infiltrating the focus groups was really, really interesting as well. And she would go like watch people do secret shopping. And then, you know, and that was an old IDEO thing where they put like cameras in grocery stores and they would watch people go around. Really cool. Let me hop to this other side and I'll come back. You had one down the end. Good question. So the question is, how do you determine the sample size or the pool of users that you use in your research? It varies based on the type of test that you're running. I can give you one example that's much easier is with A/B testing. So if you're doing A/B testing, one mistake that people make a lot with A/B testing is that they don't have a hypothesis up front. There isn't some question that they're, or assumption that they're trying to prove out. They're just like, which is better, red buttons or green buttons, right? And when you don't have that hypothesis there, which is like, you know, we think that people aren't seeing our button, and so if we make it a brighter color, more people will click on it. If you don't have that hypothesis there, it's really hard to structure the sample size, because in an A/B test, your sample size is dependent on the amount of lift that you want to see in the conversion rate. So if you had, like if it was about people clicking on a link or a button, and it was like, most people with the way that it is now, which is this like gray button, it converts at like 10% or something. And I want to see you have to define what the lift is. I want to see a 50% jump or a 20% jump. That number, that assumption of the jump that you want to see determines the sample size that you need. And in A/B testing, and I'll explain this here because I know it can be a little weird. In A/B testing, the bigger the improvement that you're looking for, the smaller the sample size needs to be. And the smaller the improvement, the bigger. They're inversely proportional. And the reason is that it's about kind of trajectory. If you're looking for a huge improvement, like 100%, I want twice as many people to click on this link as before, you're going to know pretty quickly whether or not you're on that trajectory to get there, right? Because if you're just like, hey, we already had like 10 people come through this and we didn't see any lift whatsoever, like there's no way that you're going to get up to that point. And so it's real easy for you to shut it down with a small sample size. Whereas if you're looking for like a 1% improvement, man, you could dance along that line for a long time before it would net out. So anyway, I know that's kind of a long answer, but it does vary. If you're doing qualitative research, just like, hey, I've got some new feature and I want to hear what people think about it, sometimes just a few conversations with people can be really insightful. And you might not hit some like very objective, statistically significant result, but as a product manager, you might get insights. And in some cases, that's all you're really looking for, right? Is do people like, are they even remotely close to accepting this product, or do they just kind of like dismiss it right out of the gate when I show it to them? And sometimes, you know, that kind of conversation can be really, really helpful for you. So it varies a little bit depending on the method. Yeah. Okay, the question is, for new products, what type of prototyping and then the testing of those prototypes are least expensive but still effective? That's a good question, and it can take a lot of different forms. I think the least expensive ones would be to show it to your coworkers or friends and family, right? And to create some lightweight prototype. And you can decide what that prototype is depending on kind of your skills. Like if you're a great designer and you might be able to whip up something in Envision or whatever. If you're an engineer, you might be able to create an actual functional prototype. If you're like a PM with no design or engineering experience, you know, you can use wireframing tools like Balsamiq. And, you know, Balsamiq will let you like create cool clickable mocks and stuff like that with very little technical experience. So if you're going like, hey, what's the cheapest, i.e. free, you create some kind of prototype wherever that falls on the spectrum and then test it with friends and family or coworkers, or even better, if you can find some kind of whoever you think your target user is and just show it to them that way. You can ramp it up from there without a doubt. You know, you can do like usertesting.com and other sites like that that actually do produce some really valuable data sometimes, depending on what you're trying to test. Functional prototypes work a lot better in things like usertesting.com than in others, because regardless of how good their kind of segmentation is up front for finding users who, you know, are most like your target user, they're still going to have people who have like no context and in some cases may or may not be your target user. And so it's kind of harder for them to like maybe make some of the leaps of faith, especially if you've got like some really technical product. That would be tough. And then, you know, stepping up from there, there are, you know, very robust and really cool advanced techniques for doing prototype testing, you know, where they like will bring people into a room and they'll do eye tracking, and it can be a moderated test or an unmoderated test, or they maybe have someone sitting next to them or they don't, to guide them through. And so there's a pretty big spectrum. But down in the kind of free category, I would, you know, show prototypes to whoever you can get to give you a couple minutes to do it. You can do some of the like fun little kind of hacky tricks too, where you like maybe make a landing page that describes your product and it says coming soon, and put in your email if you want to know when we launch it, and you can try to gauge some interest from things like that, and you can like run some cheap Facebook or Instagram ads against it just to drive some traffic there. And then you can do some cool demographic targeting too to see if that type of product resonates with who you think your target user is. So there are a handful of methods that you can use in that regard. I hope that's helpful.
Okay, guys, we have time for two more questions. So if it's a burning question, feel free to ask it.
Who has the best question? All right, you seem excited. Go ahead.
I don't know if that's the best question. But you mentioned that things are changing and evolving. So how do you stay up to date with both testing techniques and also product management in general?
Got it. Okay. So the question is, with things evolving so quickly, how do you keep up with it, both in terms of testing and just even product management in general? Through doing, right? I think in a lot of ways, or a lot of cases with user testing, people need to be doing it more often than they are. And so if you're not doing it very often, you're not going to keep up with some of the new methods that you might use and learn what's effective and what's not. And even if you are like, you know, subscribing to every UX research blog and things like that, there's so much value that comes from the actual practice of it and that experience that would just never come through in that sort of content. So I really think that in general, well, I mean, it's certainly good to do that kind of research and to read about some of the advanced ways that people are doing user research. But I think the most effective way for you to learn is to be doing more research than you're doing now. And you're going to keep up and you're going to find what's working and what's not. And that is going to lead you to evolve your process a lot, depending on the results that you're getting. And then it'll also give you more opportunities to test out some of the other, you know, fun, new, cutting edge types of research that you're seeing and saying, oh yeah, okay, I had heard that there was this new way to try to validate this type of assumption. Let's try this because we're doing enough research where we can, you know, take those kind of risks. All right, who else? I know you've been waiting for a while, go ahead.
Appreciate it. Do you mind if we go back actually to—
Yeah, no problem.
It's the one where you've got the net promoter scores in the table format.
Okay, I don't have a password for it, but okay. Hey, Laura, you mind?
Yeah.
Thanks.
The basics of this question is that for that example that we were showcasing there, it looked like it was for a product that has a variety of features already, and we have some assumptions about what's important for them.
Mm.
We're using Net Promoter Score to get them. So with
yep.
the ClassPass example, it sounds like the example you gave there, they had a set of assumptions that actually were problems as opposed to thoughts about a solution already. So they were saying maybe
good point. Yep.
We think that new couples who are living in metropolitan areas are going to want X or going to need some kind of resource for working out, right?
Yep.
So would you adjust this type of table and this approach based off of an early stage idea that isn't even have a solution in mind yet? They're still investigating a problem.
You could. So the question is about how relevant this chart might be for earlier stage products where you don't have some list of established features and people haven't interacted with them, so they don't necessarily have some rating for how good it is. And so how would you adjust this for those types of products, or would you? It's a good question. I think you could put assumptions in this to a certain extent, or at least assumptions about what you think the differentiators are or whatever, but that is actually going to have to come from some other research that had been done up front. And, in a lot of cases that I would think would be really natural. Like if you decided you were going to build some product, you've probably made some assumptions already about the features that need to go in there. Like I'm going to build a new alarm clock and, I know it needs to like keep time and it probably needs to have a snooze button. And maybe I want to let people pick the music that they wake up to and, maybe I want different alarms for different days of the week and things like that. And so you could put some assumptions in here, but you're right that, this does assume a little bit of an established product. And so I don't know if this would necessarily be the tool that I would use for kind of figuring out which features to build if I didn't have something already. I'd probably focus more on like what I was talking about earlier, with creating a list of assumptions that kind of have to be true in order for your product to work, and then designing research around that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Okay. Do we have time for one more?
We have time for just
one more. I know there were some other hands. Go ahead.
Yeah, so you mentioned competitive analysis at the beginning.
Mm.
So that works really good with like bigger company. You copy everything Facebook does because you assume that they do tests.
Sure.
But there's also a lot of like articles and talk about don't do what your competitor does, especially when you're early stage, because they might not test it. They might be still testing it. So how do you balance the two of like copying what other people are doing, trying to copy them or imitate them and look at that, and or also think about are they actually using, like, is it actually working?
Yeah. So the question is about the point that I raised earlier about using your competitors as a source of research and looking at some of the things they're doing and then kind of assuming that maybe they've done some research for it and then using that to inform your product features. Yeah, you're right. I think you need to be careful with that. And you need to be careful with it in both directions. One is, you can assume that they might have done some testing, but that might not be true, or that they might just be wrong. And the other direction, like, you don't want to, like, copy them 100% either. That's not a good thing to do. Because at best, you're going to have the same product that they do if you go that route, and then why would someone pick yours versus another, right? So you got to be careful, right, with using the competitive analysis. But I do think that it's an underutilized resource. Most of us are building products that are in some kind of existing industry, and there's some form of that product that exists. It's rare that we have some like, wow, this has never existed before type of product. And so there are no examples whatsoever of how people have been doing this in the past, right? So, and while there are some, but in most cases there are competitors in your space. And so I think the point I was kind of making with that earlier is that I think it's an underutilized resource there, which is that if you see that people are growing or you know that people are using their product, and in fact, maybe you can validate some of this by like saying, here's a list of features that I know my competitor has, and I'm out there now doing research, and I'm like looking at product reviews, or I'm reading their user forums and things like that, and I'm finding the features that people are really struggling with, or the features that people talk about the most, or the features that people love. You can use some of that extra information to kind of validate whether or not they've made the right decisions and then go from there. But that's a good question. Yeah, you got to be careful with just kind of borrowing from your competitors.
Can I have a really quick follow-up? Sorry.
Okay.
Just on that same note, instead of looking just at your competitors, what if you're looking at, you're like a Frankenstein product where you're taking like, oh, the best thing from this and the best thing from that. Do you think it's still valid if you're saying like, oh, this worked for this other market, could I apply those same functions to mine?
The question is it valid if you're like, you're making kind of like a hybrid product from a bunch of different industries and you want to take the best from all those industries, does that still work? You got to go back to your target customer there, right? And who is the person that you're assuming that you assume is going to use your product, and what do they care about? Do they care about kind of that feature? Because you're right, it might be the best in that industry, but best also assumes that it's best for someone. And that might not be the same person that's going to use your product, and they might have a very different concept of what best or most important or most valuable is.
Okay.